Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Are you interested in learning about how you can determine the best chance of effectiveness for when to intervene during a session? In my upcoming courses in March, I consider the implications of the studies I'm about to present in this episode and more, and then I share some strategies for observing eye contact between you and your patient during session in order to determine when is the best time to deliver interventions for your patient's success. If you'd like to learn more about this, you can find information and links on connectiontherapypodcast.com. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. This is Dr. Brenna Moreau, and I am continuing the discussion about heart rate variability, HRV. But before I do, let's consider again, what is heart rate variability and why would I continue focusing on it? HRV is a reflection of the capacity to moderate the ways one's sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems interact, meaning how one is able to regulate these systems in response to the situation the person finds themselves. This is a summary from Dr. Ina Hazan that I referenced in episode 31, if you would like a review. As mental health clinicians, we are ethically bound to stay current on dynamics that affect the style of treatment we provide. And heart rate variability research shows correlations to many physical and mental health conditions. As such, it is important we understand these things and consider if or how we might incorporate them into the way we work so that we can support our patients in achieving the best outcomes they can. In this episode, I'm going to review an article written by Dr. Donald Moss that helps us frame this discussion and presents some information we need to make this consideration about heart rate variability. The difficulty here, though, is how, as practicing clinicians, do we tie all of these theories and research into our practices? No matter what style of therapy we practice, we need to begin to consider how to incorporate the fact that improved mental health outcomes are associated with, that is, correlated with, increases in heart rate variability. At least that's what I had to do after I reviewed the research and spent some time learning about this phenomena. How might you incorporate some of the factors into your practice? I mentioned Deb Dana previously on the podcast. She is the social worker who initially supported Stephen Porges in making the polyvagal theory concepts apply to clinical work. She has some thoughts that I will share from one of her books, and to my mind, one of the reasons the partnership between her and Porges is so brilliant is that her suggestions are straightforward and likely things you are doing in your office now anyway. I'm just going to help you tie those instincts that I bet you have to the research behind why they work, and then maybe add a couple ways you could further enhance them if you so choose. So in this episode and in this current month, I am reviewing the concept of heart rate variability so that even if you never know or want to know the details about HRV, you can be assured that you are considering the implementation of factors into your practice that improve it for your patients. Let's begin. The article I'm reviewing today is called Brain-Heart Interactions and Optimizing Psychotherapy by Dr. Donald Moss, published online in the Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback Journal earlier this year on January 24th. I was introduced to Dr. Moss when he and I served on a dissertation committee together, and he was also very kind to me last year and provided me some consultation. In this paper, he considers three aims for psychotherapy: emotional regulation, social engagement, and cognitive flexibility. And he discusses the psychophysiological foundations for them by integrating some theoretical models with neurophysiological research. Stephen Porges's polyvagal theory is among the theories for which Moss provides an overview. And one thing that I appreciate is that tying theories like this to practice is so complex that it is helpful to hear from a wide variety of people. Dr. Moss shares his interpretation of key aspects of the theory and supported me in further doing that for myself. For example, he expanded on my understanding of Porges' brain-face-heart circuit by stating that the vagus nerve, quote, forms a two-way highway between the gut and the brain and the heart and the brain with many connections. So the way I think about it is the posters in a doctor's office that have the images depicted of what's inside the human body, and there are these sort of nerves that go different directions in our bodies. What Moss is describing here is Porges' idea that this vagus nerve forms a two-way highway between the gut and the brain and the heart and the brain, and then it has many connections included. He also emphasized the importance of HRV as a pathway for communication between the brain and the heart. So this one nerve is kind of doing a lot of work from a variety of areas in the body, and then it results in different activation of our nervous systems. From Dr. Ina Hazan earlier, we learned that it results in three different circuits: an immobilization circuit, an activation circuit, and a social engagement one. In the article, Moss reviewed additional concepts of how heart rate variability is indicative of cognitive flexibility and emotional regulation and facilitating social engagement. He then lists many ways to increase heart rate variability, which incidentally include many of the things on the list of ways to improve mental health that I mentioned in episode number 30. To me, it's comforting when vastly different researchers, that is the ones I cited in the previous episode, were asking and collecting data from a different perspective, and they still came up with similar activities that support mental health to the researchers in the articles cited by Moss that support increasing HRV. Things like diet and exercise make the list, but so too does compassion training, which again is similar to the earlier studies I shared. And while Moss didn't mention it per se, I have seen that animal-assisted therapy yields many of the same effects, for example, increases in oxytocin that improve outcomes. For Dr. Moss, the best recommendation to improve HRV is the inclusion of biofeedback training techniques into your psychotherapy practice. But if, like me, you have heard enough information to acknowledge the importance of heart rate variability to overall mental health, but you are not ready to change the frame of how you currently practice, then I would like to draw your attention to some of the recommendations from Deb Dana in her book, The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy, where she provided an overview of how this might be done. And then from there, I will add some of my own specific insights as well. To understand Dana's recommendations, though, we first have to remember a concept Porges introduced called neuroception. It is like the idea of perception, except he is asserting that this process lies mostly beneath conscious awareness. And it is the process where we are seeking nonverbal social cues from another in order to determine if they are a potential threat or a non-threat to us. I'd like to note this is a capability we share with our animal counterparts too, particularly other mammals. Danik gives a great explanation of this theory, helping us understand how it fits into our overall makeup as humans. We have the capacity to distinguish between different frequencies of sounds, and some of them put us into an immobilized state because they're so threatening, we're sort of stunned and we are immobilized. And some of them put us into an activated state because their frequencies suggest that we might need to defend ourselves in a fight or flight manner. And then there's ways that we can read the social cues of another, their eyes, their tone of voice, and we can regulate our system in preparation for social engagement. So we kind of can calm ourselves down enough to engage socially with another being. And she explains that it's not the words themselves that someone else might speak to us, but it's the pattern of rhythm and sound, as well as the cues that their eyes are making, along with other facial features like the smile, that help us conclude that we can relax into an environment that is considered safe, and our social engagement system can be the one that we are operating from in that environment. As always, I will list the quotes and ways to find this information in her book, along with our other resources for this podcast on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. She goes on to explain that two elements are needed to create a neuroception of safety. The first is we have to resolve the cues of danger, and then we can bring in the cues of safety. So for therapists, I feel like this is the most important part, is we can encourage a feeling of safety in our therapy offices every session, but until we also become aware of and perceive how to remove any concerns that might feel like they are cueing unsafe or danger to our patients, then we will continually be in a state where our patients can't fully relax into that social engagement circuit of the vagus nerve, and they'll have trouble receiving all the benefits of therapy because their defense mechanisms will still be activated. So this has pretty significant implications for us as therapists, because we not only have to set an environment, but we have to be perceptive and alert for our patients, whether something is actually unsafe or not. But we have to learn to be able to start reading when their own system may be overly activated. In the example of someone who's experienced chronic trauma for many years, they're going to come into our offices on alert, and we can't do anything about that initial perception that they may have. Even if it's not our intent, that doesn't matter. It's how they perceive the environment that matters. And so we have to be able to separate our intentions and our, you know, good motivations from what the person is actually experiencing in order to start being able to support them in experiencing what we're actually meaning in our offices, is that, you know, it's an area for safety. How does she suggest doing that? She's got a nice, straightforward list here. She says, quote, ongoing opportunities for co-regulation, reliable relationships based on reciprocity, and time spent with safe people engaging in shared activities are all important elements of an enlivened neuroception of safety. So as I mentioned earlier, my guess is you are already trying to set your offices up in this way. Nonverbally and verbally, I'm sure you're wanting to create safe spaces for your patients. Looking at this list again, things like ongoing opportunities for co-regulation. Most therapists would create opportunities for co-regulation in every talk therapy situation where you're empathizing with the emotion someone brings into session, and you kind of have that affect matching so that you're in a space to receive and be receptive to whatever it is they're sharing. And she also mentions reliable relationships based on reciprocity. In episode 8, for example, I talked about play therapy interventions that have eye contact as part of the reciprocity. And Dr. Bruce Perry also discussed why this is important. And it's reinforced here by Dana. That would include also the next item on her list, time spent with safe people engaging in shared activities. So many of these things, I'm pretty sure most therapists have a kind of natural inclination to do, but hopefully now you have a little bit more confidence that in so doing, you are helping to have your patients practice being in that social engagement circuit of their vagal activity. And by extension, vagal activity increases heart rate variability, which increases the possibility for improved mental health outcomes. And one thing I would like to add here is in my work with equine assisted services, I started noticing how this works in groups of horses and also across species between humans and horses. And I've mentioned some of that in the podcast up to this point, but I'm going to continue in future episodes to support you in discerning one facial feature that can provide an indicator of your patient's vagal activity. And that is how the eye contact between you and your patient is moving between you. It has to do with some of the research I mentioned in the last episode, number 32, about how in our mammal counterparts, in that case horses, eyes show a reflection of the vagal activity. And so then we can be confident that when we're watching eye contact between us and our patients, that it's an indicator of what's happening internally for them and their vagal activity. So I will continue to share that so that you can start to see if your patients are operating from this immobilization, mobilization, or social engagement state. And that'll help you also be able to discern what is happening in the interaction between you and your patients. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.